name than could recognize an oak tree or an otter. Science education, especially ecology and earth-based sciences in America, is falling behind that of other countries. Biological, health, and economic data indicate that children who connect with nature perform better in school, have higher SAT scores, exhibit fewer behavioral challenges, and experience fewer attention deficit disorders. All you need to do is see young children exploring a garden or a riverbank to know that we are hardwired to enjoy and revere nature, but in modern times, that instinct tends to get buried the older we get. That's probably what Mahatma Gandhi had in mind when he observed, "To forget how to dig the earth and to tend the soil is to forget ourselves." That's the spirit we have to reawaken if we want and expect that people will vote with their money, their voices, and their ballots to preserve the natural world. As my adventure travel partner Glenn Prickett always says to me, you have to see it to save it. Once you've seen a tropical rainforest in Sumatra framed by lush green rice paddies and garlanded by trumpet flowers, which look just like their name, pink flowers shaped like trumpets hanging down from every branch of a large bush, you'll want to save it. Once you've seen the sun rise on the Masai Mara in Kenya and a parade of giraffes walking single file by your camp at dawn as you shave in the mirror, you'll want to save it. Once you've tramped through the Amazonian rainforests of Peru, dodged wild boar, and fed macaws from your shoulder at your breakfast table, you'll want to save it. I was at a seminar once where the environmental pioneer Amory Lovins was asked by a member of the audience, what is the single most important thing an environmentalist can do today? He answered with two words, pay attention. Because when you really see it, you'll want to save it. In 2006, when our family was touring the Peruvian rainforest, we had a remarkable indigenous guide named Gilbert. He always led the way. He carried no phone, no binoculars, no iPod, no radio. He did not suffer from that disease of the modern age, continuous partial attention, always trying to do 10 tasks at once. Just the opposite. He was always and only paying attention to what was happening around him. He heard every chirp, whistle, howl, or crackle in the rainforest and would stop us in our tracks and immediately identify what bird, insect, or animal it was. He also had incredible vision and never missed a spider's web, a butterfly, a toucan, or column of marching termites. He was totally disconnected from the web, but totally in touch with the incredible web of life around him. I always felt there was a lesson there. At the end of the day, no amount of investing, no amount of clean electrons, no amount of energy efficiency will save the natural world if we are not paying attention to it. If we are not paying attention to all the things that nature gives us for free, clean air, clean water, breathtaking vistas, mountains for skiing, rivers for fishing, oceans for sailing, sunsets for poets, and landscapes for painters. What good is it to have wind-powered lights to brighten the night if you can't see anything green in the day? Just because we can't sell shares in nature doesn't mean it has no value. Without an ethic of conservation, we will lose that which is priceless but has no price tag. Chapter 14. Outgreening Al-Qaeda, or Buy One, Get Four Free. When we leave Iraq, it will be the biggest transfer of air conditioners ever known to mankind. Dan Nolan, energy consultant to the U.S. Army. Who ever heard of a Green Hawk before? A tough-minded Army or Marine officer who's as green an advocate of solar power as any sandal-wearing, bicycle-riding, yogurt-eating flower child in Berkeley. Green Hawks, though, are just one of the new forces emerging in the energy climate era as a wide variety of different groups come to understand that green is not simply a strategy for producing cleaner power, energy efficiency, and conservation, as important as those things are. It's also a strategy for winning in many different contexts. In the coming years, people are going to discover that they can outgreen their competition in the marketplace, on the battlefield, in the design studio, and even in the struggle against poverty. It won't be long before outgreening will be found in the dictionary, somewhere between outflank and outmaneuver. I first realized that outgreening could be a military strategy after I learned about the Green Hawks movement in the U.S. military. This informal group of like-minded officers emerged in 2006 after a U.S. Marine general in Iraq's Anbar province, Major General Richard C. Zillmer, began to complain to the Pentagon that he needed some alternatives to diesel fuel to power his outposts on the Syrian border. One of the most dangerous tasks for Marines in that area was driving trucks loaded with 10-gallon tanks of diesel out to isolated observation posts to run the mobile generators that were powering their air conditioners, radios, and other equipment. Either there was no electricity grid, or it was not functioning in these remote areas, and the fuel convoys had become big, fat, delicious targets for Iraqi insurgents with roadside bombs. At the time, the Pentagon was already working with Amory Lovins of the Rocky Mountain Institute to find more energy-efficient ways to operate generally, but the demand from the field, said Lovins, created much greater urgency for the U.S. military to figure out ways to eat its tail. That is, to shorten its energy supply lines by finding renewable and distributed sources of power. It started with a single commander in Anbar, explained Dan Nolan, who headed the Power Surety Task Force for the U.S. Army's Rapid Equipping Force, which deals with energy logistics, when the request from General Zillmer came up the chain. When we began the analysis of his request, it was really about the fact that his soldiers were being attacked on the roads, bringing fuel and water. So eating their tail, said Nolan, meant trying to satisfy the energy needs of far-flung outposts with renewable power and energy efficiency that could be generated on-site rather than from diesel fuel trucked in from afar. Thus began the Army's first comprehensive attempt at what I would call outgreening Al-Qaeda, trying to take away Al-Qaeda's advantage of being a very distributed, low-energy guerrilla force against a concentrated, high-energy-consuming conventional army by looking for a green solution. Nothing, and I mean nothing, will make you a believer in distributed solar power faster than having responsibility for trucking fuel across Iraq. I met two soldiers at the sprawling U.S. military base in Balad, Iraq, 50 miles north of Baghdad, who had undergone that conversion. Their unit was responsible for supplying DF-2 diesel fuel to smaller outposts all over the northern Iraqi battle space to keep their generators running. The day I visited, August 25, 2007, the temperature hit 121 degrees Fahrenheit. Air conditioning a tent in the desert when it is 121 degrees outside takes a lot of energy, which is why, at the time, about 70% of the U.S. Central Command's energy budget was being spent just moving fuel from one base to another. Even in the best of times and in the most temperate conditions, wars are a huge energy drain, and military equipment, in the past at least, has rarely been designed with energy efficiency in mind. Before they came to Iraq, the only thing green about Sergeant Major Mark Weavadow and Sergeant Major Stacy Davis would have been their uniforms. But months of managing fuel and food convoys, as well as route clearance, sweeping the roads of IEDs, improvised explosive devices, before they blew up a convoy about to pass, had made the two of them advocates of any kind of distributed energy that would diminish the number of fuel trucks that needed to be escorted and roads that needed to be cleared. Because the electricity system in Iraq is so decrepit and so vulnerable, explained Sergeant Major Davis, we don't rely on the Iraqi grid at all. Everything is run off generators. You can't walk 100 feet without running into a generator here, and they run 24/7 until they run out of fuel. If the Army had distributed solar or wind power, Sergeant Major Weavadow told me, it would eliminate putting soldiers on the road, and that is the most dangerous thing we do. Keeping people off the roads is the most important thing we can do. Why can't we have solar and wind turbines out here? I see them every time I drive on the Pennsylvania Turnpike. Why don't I see them here? It took a while after General Zillmer first raised the issue for the Pentagon to realize that the best way to try to win the fight against IEDs was not just by adding armor, but by greening the Army, said Department of Defense energy consultant Linton Wells II. If a couple of 155mm mortar rounds buried in a road can flip an Abrams tank, you can make yourself more safe with more armor, but not safe enough, said Wells. We want to have a zero-casualty war, and that leads you to 60-ton vehicles that won't fit on an airlifter. The only answer is more distributed energy. The best way to beat an IED, he added, is to not be there when it goes off. Distributed energy puts fewer people at risk and requires less equipment than diesel does. It would also mean fewer grainy videos on Al-Qaeda websites of U.S. military vehicles being dramatically blown apart, and lower energy costs for the military so it could buy other equipment more useful to the fight. Energy independence is not an economic issue, said Nolan, a retired Army colonel who was assigned with his group to come up with energy-saving solutions for the Iraqi battlefront. It's not a resource issue. It's a national security issue. It's the right business for us to be in. It certainly is when you're involved in something as complicated as occupying another country, as we have done in Iraq, said Nolan. The United States does not want to give the wrong impression to the local population, so it tries to put up temporary structures so people don't think we are about a permanent occupation, he explained. What that means, though, is that the Army relies on a lot of tents. The Army tent is our standard temporary structure, said Nolan, to ensure the soldiers can get sleep and that the electronics inside the office tents will work right. You have to air condition these temporary structures. Generally speaking, there are some places we could tie into the local grid in Iraq, but you have to ask yourself, should we be taking energy away from the local community? That also makes you more vulnerable when someone cuts one line and your whole army base goes black. So, more often than not, we bring in our own tactical generators, said Nolan. But these need to be fueled with diesel, trucked in from outside, usually Kuwait, but also Turkey and Jordan. Nolan and his team attacked the problem by first visiting forward operating bases in Iraq. Our survey found that in just one small forward operating base, we were bringing in about 10,000 gallons a day of diesel. This was a small base, and 9,000 gallons were used for generators and the rest for mobility. and 95% of that generator power was used to air-condition tents. After analyzing all the battlefield data, Nolan and his team sat back and asked themselves, where can we have the biggest impact that will not compromise military capability? You had to take a holistic view and think about it as an energy system, said Nolan. If I tell a tactical commander, I am going to give you solar mirrors and windmills, his reaction will not be positive. But if I tell him that I have a system for supplementing his conventional power with renewables that will give him more tactical flexibility, he will be more comfortable with that idea. Nolan's project happened to dovetail with work that the Pentagon had already been doing, work based on a February 2008 Defense Science Board report called More Fight, Less Fuel. The report noted that the need to deliver high volumes of fuel to operational forces creates a large logistics tail, which is vulnerable to attack by insurgent forces and difficult to protect, and that, as a result, fuel delivered in this way costs a lot more money than it does at your corner gas station. The Defense Science Board first recognized this issue in 2001 and coined the concept the fully burdened cost of fuel. As Tom Morehouse, a former Air Force officer and another member of the informal Green Hawks Brigade at the Pentagon, explained to me, the U.S. military was not making decisions about weapon systems based on the fully burdened cost of fuel, which is the commodity price of the fuel plus the cost to deliver that fuel to the end user plus the cost of the contractors and trucks that drive that fuel, plus the cost of protecting that fuel all along the way, plus the cost of tending to casualties from transporting that fuel. When the Army started to look at this holistically, it found that the fully burdened cost of delivering a gallon of fuel in the Iraqi military theater was at least $20 a gallon, and for many missions went upwards of hundreds of dollars per gallon for ground forces, explained Morehouse. Fuel delivered by airborne tanker aircraft actually costs the Air Force $42 per gallon. That got people's attention. The first initiative Nolan and his team focused on was improving energy efficiency. They worked with suppliers to develop a technique for the exterior insulation of tents. We sprayed commercially available foam insulation on the outside of the tents, creating an air barrier capability to that structure, which lowered the requirements for air conditioning by 40 to 75%, he explained. You have to get as much savings as you can at the front end from efficiency, so the amount of renewable energy you have to generate at the back end is as little as possible and will go much farther. If I have a base that is demanding 2 megawatts of electricity every day, trying to provide all that with solar or wind or other alternatives is impossible. But if I can take the demand down through efficiency savings to 500 kilowatts a day, then my alternative energy can work. The Army liked this approach enough to buy sufficient foam to insulate thousands of tents and containerized living units in Iraq. It was so cost-effective, achieving those 40 to 75% reductions in air conditioning, which meant a huge reduction in fuel costs, that Nolan and his team were encouraged to explore a more advanced version of this technology. In this iteration, a large domed temporary structure was insulated with foam from the outside and then covered from the inside with a thin layer of concrete. This tent can sleep 40 soldiers, 4 times the average tent, has more ballistic protection thanks to the concrete, and, Nolan says, with 2 mobile wind turbines and 2 sun-tracking solar panels, plus an emergency backup propane generator, it can produce enough energy to air condition and power the whole living space and have some left over to give to the nearby village. The U.S. Army is now working to perfect this system so it can be deployed in Iraq or Afghanistan at scale. This is typical of what happens when you try to solve a problem by outgreening the competition. You buy one, and you get four free. In Nolan's case, you save lives by getting convoys off the road, save money by lowering fuel costs, and maybe have some power left over to give to the local mosque's imam so his community might even toss a flower at you one day rather than a grenade. There is one more, less visible benefit from Nolan's point of view. Soldiers see this kind of solution applied to their base in Iraq and then come back to America and demand the same thing for their community or from their factory. When the army desegregated, the country really desegregated. If the army could go green, the country could really go green. Just as the army showed blacks and whites that they could work together, the army can be the laboratory that shows people how to go green together. That kind of thing starts to change the whole culture, said Nolan. If we can get this out to Iraq, soldiers are going to come back and say, "Why can't I have this at home?" Nolan, a broad-shouldered veteran who looks more like Patton than a tree hugger, concluded, "When we think about green, we have to think about it differently than how we thought about it in the past. And we have to change our perspective. It has tremendous tactical relevance to us." I couldn't help but ask, is anybody in the military saying, "Oh gosh, poor Dan has gone green. Has he gone girly man on us now?" Answered Nolan with a big laugh, "I'm okay with that." I am okay with that too, because I believe that we are on the cusp of an era when outgreening will become a strategy for achieving competitive advantage in a variety of fields. The term outgreen was coined by my friends Maria and Dove Seidman over a breakfast we had one morning. Dove is the founder and CEO of LRN, which helps companies build ethical corporate cultures. He is also the author of a book called How: Why How We Do Anything Means Everything in Business and in Life. The simple thesis of How is that in today's totally wired world, you are set apart by how you conduct yourself. Everyone is so much more transparent and connected than ever before. As a result, so many more people can now see more deeply into what you do and into your company's operations and tell so many more other people about it via the internet without any editor or filter. Therefore, how you live your life, how you conduct your business, and how you say you're sorry or don't matter now more than ever. While this can be a liability, it can also be an asset for an individual or business. Today, whatever product you make or service you offer can quickly and easily be copied and sold by everyone anywhere. But how you do your business, argues Dove, how you keep your promises, and how you relate to customers, colleagues, suppliers, and the communities in which you operate are much more difficult to copy if you are doing them well. That creates an opportunity for sustainable differentiation. When it comes to human conduct, there is tremendous variation. And where a broad spectrum of variation exists, opportunity exists, he explained. The tapestry of human behavior is so varied, so rich, and so globally diverse, he added, that it presents a rare opportunity. The opportunity to outbehave the competition. How can you outbehave the competition? In Michigan, Dove notes, one hospital taught its doctors to apologize when they made mistakes and dramatically cut malpractice claims. That's how. But now you can also outgreen the competition, and you can outgreen your enemies. In a world of seemingly limitless abundance, In a world that was not hot, flat, and crowded, the natural strategy was to try to outproduce or outspend the competition, said Dove. So a country with a lot of agricultural land could outgrow the competition. A country with a lot of forests could outcut the competition. A country with a lot of mines could outstrip the competition. A country with a lot of oil could outpump the competition. A country with a lot of raw materials could outsell the competition. That's why the dictionary is full of words like outspend or outproduce, added Dove. Because these were deeply ingrained habits of thought and behavior when resources were abundant, and you had the capital or resources, and your competition didn't. This mindset was immortalized in the climactic scene of the movie There Will Be Blood, when Daniel Plainview, the greedy oil baron, explains to a naive preacher, Eli Sunday, who is offering Plainview a lease for oil drilling, that he doesn't need his lease. He has already exploited the preacher's land. He just drilled diagonally from his property over to the preacher's property and sucked out all his oil. Plainview.
That land has been had. Nothing you can do about it. It's gone. It's had. You lose.
Eli Sunday. If you would just take this lease, Daniel. Plainview.
Drainage! Drainage, Eli, you boy. Drain dry. I'm so sorry. Here, if you have a milkshake, and I have a milkshake, and I have a straw. There it is, that's a straw, you see? You watching? And my straw reaches across the room and starts to drink your milkshake. I drink your milkshake. I drink it up.
In today's increasingly resource-constrained world, it is not so easy anymore to drink someone else's milkshake, and that is why outgreening is going to become more and more important. As noted earlier, in a world that is hot, flat, and crowded, either the market, your society, the global community, or Mother Nature is going to make you pay the true, fully burdened cost to the planet for whatever you do and however you do it. For whatever you own, whatever you make, whatever you transport, and however you choose to live. A strategy that depends on out-mining, out-drilling, out-consuming, out-exploiting your own resources or a global commons without having to pay any of the externalities is not going to offer a sustainable competitive advantage any longer. Instead, as society, the market, and Mother Nature increasingly impose the true costs of how we use energy and natural resources through carbon taxes, gasoline taxes, regulation, and public opinion, or by simply changing the weather in ways that become dangerously destabilizing, the greenest, cleanest, and most efficient manufacturers, institutions, products, countries, schools, communities, and families will thrive the most for the longest. But outgreening requires a wholly different mindset. It is not just about taking, making, or mining more. Instead of digging or drilling deeper into the ground, you have to dig and drill deeper into yourself, your company, or your community. Instead of mining the environment, you have to create a different kind of environment. A collaborative environment in which you, your company, and your community are constantly thinking about how to generate more growth, more mobility, more housing, more comfort, more security, more enjoyment, and more packaging from the most innovative use of the cleanest electrons and fewest resources. When you start to drill inside yourself or your own company or your own community, for more sustainable ways to power your future, all kinds of good things start to happen. You lower your energy bills. You raise your innovation capacities because it is impossible to make a product greener without also making it smarter. Smarter materials, smarter designs, or smarter software. You develop export products that will be in global demand. You get cleaner air and water. And you will have a better handle on your costs. Solar and wind power may be more expensive to install today, but the price of the fuel, sun and wind, are fixed. They will be free forever. Fossil fuel systems may be cheaper to install today, but the prices of these fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, are constantly fluctuating, and with carbon taxes of one kind or another, part of the future, and demand for these fuels steadily rising in America and elsewhere, they are clearly heading upward in price. Uncertainty costs money, says David Edwards of Vantage Point Venture Partners, and it is now the fossil fuels that have increasingly uncertain prices attached to them, and prices that are trending upward, and it is the renewables that have increasingly certain prices attached to them, and prices that are trending downward. Here's the story in a nutshell, says Edwards. For many years, the developed world thrived by maximizing what seemed like free resources, fossil fuels, basic commodities, land, and water. Today, with the developing world building ever-expanding economies, we are now discovering that those resources that we built on for so long are either finite or no longer nearly free. So, with demand increasing and costs increasing, if you are in an economy that is reliant on fossil fuels, you can be nearly certain that your energy costs will be consistently higher in the future. This is not the 1970s. That oil shortage was driven by geopolitics. This shortage is driven by geology and demography. If you are in an economy that is reliant on clean technologies, though, said Edwards, the long-term economics are going to be very different. If you install a wind turbine or solar panel or geothermal plant today, he said, you know what the cost will be to deliver energy from that source for 10 or 20 years. We also know that the technology underlying those renewable energy sources is reducing the cost to install new solar panels or wind turbines every year. Therefore, the economy with the largest percentage of clean energy sources will have the most certainty around its future energy costs, much more than an economy that is entirely dependent on fossil fuels. In the long run, being cheapest means being greenest, said Edwards. That is why outgreening is going to be a source of competitive advantage, and that is why America should see itself in a worldwide race to build a clean energy infrastructure. If I am correct that clean energy will be the cheapest source of energy, said Edwards, we should be racing to build the cheapest clean energy faster than any other nation. If we win that race, we will have a major advantage over other nations that are saddled with the high costs of fossil energy. We will have a major advantage in energy-intensive manufacturing industries. And we will become a destination for international investment to take advantage of our energy infrastructure. Moreover, the more you are seen as outgreening your competition, the more people will want to work for your firm, because green as a value will increasingly be something everyone, young people especially, will want to associate with, and therefore the greenest companies, countries, schools, and cities will attract the most talent. When your mindset shifts to outgreening, said Dov Seidman, you stop thinking about accumulating more than someone else, and you start thinking about innovation. That's why it drives me nuts to hear companies or institutions talking about becoming carbon neutral. That's crazy. In a world that is hot, flat, and crowded, Why would anyone want to settle for being just carbon neutral when there is so much to be gained from having a carbon advantage? Is your company striving to be information neutral? Do half your employees use computers and half use paper, pencils, and abacuses? I learned this from David Douglas, Vice President for Eco-Responsibility for Sun Microsystems, who first raised the issue in an essay on BusinessWeek.com, January 2, 2008. Carbon neutrality misses the point. Why pay money for someone else to plant trees to make up for your carbon excesses? It's good for companies to invest in others' good deeds, but right now it's absolutely critical that companies invest in creating more sustainable versions of themselves, said Douglas. Companies whose environmental strategy is defined by trying to be carbon neutral are generally doing some efficiency projects here, purchasing some green energy there, and offsetting the rest. Is this bad to do? Asked Douglas. Of course not. Their efficiency gains help them and the atmosphere. Their green energy purchases help grow the investment in even more green energy. And if they bought quality offsets, those should spur further greenhouse gas reductions somewhere in the economy. These are all good things. We're doing them too. But I personally don't believe they'll get us where we need to get to. We need companies that view climate change not as a threat, but as an opportunity, and are pursuing it with the enthusiasm that big opportunities engender. We need companies to go beyond carbon neutrality to something I call carbon advantage. Seeking carbon advantage is a strategy for outgreening. You can create a carbon advantage for your company in two ways, explains Douglas. First, you can use efficiency and resource reduction to provide a fundamental cost advantage in your operations and products. Second, you can use innovation in green products and services to offer customers a competitive advantage, thus differentiating your offerings. Companies that have created more eco-friendly goods, such as carmaker Toyota Motor and carpetmaker Interface, are increasing their market share and improving their business performance. But more important, there's increasing evidence we're on the edge of a new, virtuous business cycle. Companies seeking sustainability look for sustainable products and services, which provides further opportunities for sustainable companies. As a result, products and services that can help customers improve their own sustainability will be in increasing demand, creating the opportunity for major shifts in market share and net reduction in business impact on the environment. If Toyota uses their environmental efforts solely toward carbon neutrality, they never build a Prius, added Douglas. They don't dig inside themselves and think about how to create a whole new level of efficiency that can get an edge on the competition. I am struck by the myriad ways people are already trying to outgreen their competition. Let me give a couple of real-world examples, starting with New York City. Cities compete in the age of globalization more than ever. They compete for talent to move in, start companies, and generate income and tax revenues. They compete for tourists. They compete for company headquarters and capital investments. They compete to keep young people from fleeing to the suburbs or elsewhere. In 2005, David Yaske, a New York City council member, sat down with one of his supporters, Jack Hittery, a technology entrepreneur, to brainstorm about how New York City could make itself more livable and outgreen competing cities by making New York's taxi fleet less toxic. Yaske and Hittery started by checking with the Taxi and Limousine Commission to see what it would take to replace the gas-guzzling Ford Crown Victoria yellow cabs, which got only around 10 miles per gallon, with better mileage, low-emission hybrids. It sounded like a great idea, but it turned out to be illegal, thanks to some old regulations mandating how big a taxi had to be, regulations designed to favor Crown Vicks and their manufacturer, Ford. Recalled Hittery, "When they first told me, I said, 'Are you serious? Illegal?'" Hittery's response was to go out and form a nonprofit called SmartTransportation.org to help Yaski persuade others on the city council to change the laws to permit hybrid taxis. In order to broaden their base of support, they went beyond the simple issue of pollution and exposed what a health issue dirty air had become for New York City children with the help of Louise Vetter, CEO of the American Lung Association of the City of New York. "New York City has some of the dirtiest air in the U.S., Ms. Vetter explained to me. "When it comes to ozone and particulate matter, New Yorkers are breathing very unhealthy air. Most of it is tailpipe emissions. And in New York City, where asthma rates are among the highest in the nation, the high ozone levels create very serious threats, especially for kids who spend a lot of time outdoors. Converting cabs from yellow to green would be a great gift to the city's children." Matt Douse, who heads the taxi commission, was initially dubious. He was typical of many leaders, not hostile, just not really aware that green could be better. But once he was persuaded of the health and other benefits of hybrid vehicles, he joined forces with Yaski and Hittery, and the measure passed the city council by 50-0 on June 30, 2005. Today, more than 1,000 of New York City's 13,000 taxis are hybrids, mostly Ford Escapes, but also Toyota Highlanders and Priuses, and others. On May 22, 2007, Mayor Michael Bloomberg, one of the most environmentally conscientious mayors in America, decided to push even further, proposing a new law, which the Taxi Commission eventually approved, that would not just permit, but require all cabs to be hybrids or other low-emission vehicles that get at least 30 miles per gallon within 5 years. When it comes to health and safety and environmental issues, government should be setting standards, the mayor said. What you need are leaders who are willing to push for standards that are in society's long-term interest. When the citizens see the progress, Mr. Bloomberg added, then they start to lead. And this encourages leaders to seek even higher standards. In the summer of 2007, I asked Evgeny Friedman, a top New York City fleet operator, how he liked the hybrids. "Absolutely fabulous. We started out with 18, and now we have over 200. Now we only put hybrids out there," he said. "The drivers are demanding them, and the public is demanding them. It has been great economically. With gas prices as they are, then around $3 per gallon, the drivers are saving $30 a shift." He said drivers who were getting 7 to 10 miles per gallon from their Crown Vicks and buying their own gas out of fares and tips were getting 25 to 30 from their hybrids. "The cost of shifting to these hybrids," he added, "has not been onerous." Having begun to green the taxi fleet, Hittery, Bloomberg, and Rohit Agarwala, the mayor's top advisor on sustainability, turned their attention to an even worse problem. The 12,000 or so Lincoln Town Cars and other black limousines that are also huge polluters, especially when they sit idling on the doorsteps of Manhattan's top law firms and investment banks, waiting for their clients to get out of meetings. This was a harder problem to solve because there was no obsolescence law covering limos, unlike taxis. You could keep one of those big black boats on the road as long as you wanted. Hittery started this campaign by taking pictures of the black town cars lined up outside the offices of the major New York City law firms and investment banks. I then FedExed a letter to the CEOs of each organization with a picture pointing out that all these idling town cars in front of their offices was a problem, said Hittery, a man who knows how to get things done. A car that is idling produces 20 times the pollution that a car going 30 miles an hour does, because a car is made to move, not to idle. So this car, idling with the heater or air conditioning running full blast because the client wants to walk into a perfect environment, was producing a tremendous amount of pollution, and the largest corporations and law firms were directly responsible. Hittery said he was surprised by how quickly the operation heads of all these firms got back to him. Not only were they positively inclined to try to do something, he said, but the number one thing that came out was the retention issue. Say what? They saw going green as a way of attracting and retaining young talent, Hittery explained. Hotshot young lawyers and bankers would rather be whisked around town in hybrids than in town cars. There is only so much of an arms race you can do by offering dollars and salary or better food in the cafeteria. They immediately saw this as a differentiator. My law firm is greener than yours. Most of the banks and law firms quickly called their limousine companies, asking when they plan to introduce hybrids. The limousine companies quickly saw which way the wind was blowing and asked the mayor to pass a new regulation so there would be a level playing field and no one could avoid making the new investment in cleaner vehicles. Bloomberg quickly accommodated. On February 28, 2008, Bloomberg announced that beginning in 2009, all black cars will have to become green. They will have to get at least 25 miles per gallon and, by 2010, 30 miles per gallon, emissions and mileage standards that can be met by town car-sized vehicles only if they are hybrids. As the Christian Science Monitor noted the morning after the announcement, goodbye town car, 15 miles per gallon, hello Toyota Camry Hybrid, 34 mpg. Although hybrids cost $7,000 to $10,000 more than the typical town car, Hittery said the owners were expected to save $5,000 a year on fuel, or about half of what they spend today, and that was before gasoline reached $4 a gallon. Deutsche Bank America's Merrill Lynch and Lehman Brothers set up financing mechanisms to help the town car drivers, who are mostly independent operators, finance new vehicles. The whole process is also spurring technical innovation. On February 20, 2008, New York City announced that it was working with automobile design firms to come up with new performance standards for the taxi of tomorrow. Don't assume because the driver behind the wheel of a cab or a limousine speaks with a foreign accent that he or she doesn't want a healthier, sustainable lifestyle for their kids, says Hittery. Why do you think they came here in the first place? So their families could have a better quality of life. Go to any cabbie in New York, and they'll say they can't wait to get a hybrid. When the Big Apple becomes the Green Apple, when New York tries to outgreen Chicago, Beijing, or Detroit by greening its cab fleets, only good things happen, starting with the more than 45 million visitors coming through New York City every year, taking at least one hybrid taxi ride and going back home to their cities and asking, why don't we have hybrid cabs? Buy one, cleaner air from cleaner taxis and limos, and get four free. Happier drivers, a better image for your city, smaller vehicles on your roads, and more innovation around hybrid vehicles. Hug shareholders, not just trees. In his role as Vice President for Eco-Responsibility for Sun Microsystems, David Douglas does outgreening for a living. He is the first person to tell you that the best outgreening ideas often come from below, from those closest to the action. One day I got an email from one of the staff in our documentation group, he explained. She writes to me with an idea for how to cut the amount of paper we're sending with our products to customers. What we were doing was sending a complete set of instructions and manuals with every server we sold. If a company ordered 10 servers, they got 10 manuals, and our large customers were ordering hundreds, so they got hundreds of manuals. So instead, we made the manuals a separate option that customers could request. As a result, we cut 60% of the paper used and saved hundreds of thousands of dollars, because most companies just needed a couple manuals for each data center. Similarly, we recently decided not to print our annual shareholder report, and we put it on the web instead. We saved 99 million sheets of paper, all of which would be thrown away, roughly 12,000 trees, 9 million gallons of fresh water, and the best part? $600,000. It is amazing the changes in behavior we can produce when we just start to pay attention to our energy and resource productivity. Marcy Lin, Sun's corporate social responsibility program manager, based at the company's headquarters in Santa Clara, California, told me this story. We were running a pilot project on our team because we were trying to see how much energy people use at work at a time when many people were working at home a lot. I work full-time in an office, so as part of this pilot project, they mailed us extension cords that had this thing on the end called a kilowatt, which monitors how you are using electricity. So I plug in everything in my office, except the lights, into this extension power strip, and then I plug that into the kilowatt, and then into the wall. Each day, we would get an email from this lady reminding us that we have to report what was the starting reading on the kilowatt and what was the ending reading and how many hours. It was fascinating. We use sun rays, not PCs, and it is amazing how little energy they burn. But here was the problem. My office is really cold because it is near a server room, and the server room has to be air-conditioned all the time. I remember one day in particular, I had the space heater running, and I was shocked at how much energy it consumed, and I had to report these numbers. If you're going to count, you have to count. I was embarrassed to the point that it was behavior-changing. I waited until my fingers got blue. I didn't want this lady to know how much electricity I was using because I was on the eco team. Now, I keep a blanket in my office. Marcy Lin reached for a new blanket because that was the only option available to her. But Sun eventually reached for a new system because what was happening to Marcy Lin was happening on a much bigger scale to all its customers. It was getting too expensive to air condition all those servers, and, as a result, Sun found that it needed to save energy to save its business, and it couldn't just give out blankets. Outgreening became a survival strategy. If Sun could not outgreen its competition by offering more and more computing power for less energy, its business was literally going to brown out. A little background. While the Internet and World Wide Web may seem invisible, residing somewhere out there in the ether, in fact, they reside in a network of interconnected data centers, also known as server farms. These data centers usually hold thousands of computer servers jam-packed on racks, one on top of the other, which store and transmit the data and web pages available on the Internet. Sun makes these servers, among other things. This is a big part of its business. Together, all of these servers in all of these data centers are known as the cloud. And today, more and more of what you do when you fire up your computer doesn't happen on the little hard drive under your desk, but actually happens out there in the network cloud. Every time you punch out a text message on your cell phone, or make a call, it is being processed by servers and routed by servers, and the billing information stored and sent out to you by servers. If you pay your phone bill online, that is processed by servers as well. Every time you search on Google or send an email through Yahoo or use online live software from Microsoft or store a document on AOL or add to your Facebook page or upload a video onto YouTube or buy a book from Amazon.com or add to a Wikipedia page or fiddle around with the Linux operating system, you are actually working not on your home computer or PDA, but through them to the data centers that make up the cloud. And as a report by the American Technology CEO Council entitled A Smarter Shade of Green, February 2008, noted, today, it can cost more to power and cool a server over its lifetime than it does to buy the server. And information technology facilities are running out of cooling capacity and power. All the servers in America today would take about 6 or 7 1-gigawatt nuclear power plants to keep running 24/7, with that number going up every year. And that was the start of a new wave of problems for Sun and the computing industry generally. Starting in 2006, said Douglas, customers in the business districts of New York and London started coming to Sun and saying, I can't get more electricity to cool my data center, so I can't buy anything new from you unless I turn something else off. In Tokyo, the full nightmare came true. The price for just powering and air conditioning a server over its 3-year lifetime started to exceed the price of a standard industry server, about $5,000. Unless we could make a more energy-efficient server, we couldn't sell more servers, said Douglas. And because customers also needed more and more computing power to run all these new applications, as more and more people started to do their work in the cloud, Sun concluded that it needed a solution offering more brain power from less electric power. In a carbon and energy-constrained world, Sun needed to outgreen itself and the competition. Sun quickly understood, said Douglas, if we didn't become the most energy-efficient company, we would not be in business. But if we could make more energy-efficient servers than our competitors, we could take market share. So, in 2002, Sun began developing a new processing chip, codenamed Niagara. Sun's bet in designing Niagara was that for many of today's applications, the most important thing was the ability to do many tasks at once, but none of them individually at Porsche speed. This was a departure from the industry tradition of focusing on peak speed, which enabled chips to do one or two things at a time very quickly. Sun's observation was that even though the top speed of a 260-mile-per-hour Porsche sounds very cool, if the task at hand is to get 60 people from one place to another, a bus can do it both faster and more energy efficiently. The Niagara processing chip allowed Sun, for example, to process many eBay bids at one time on each server, which allows us to get more total work done with less total power than something built purely for peak speed, according to Douglas. Today, Sun's Niagara-based server line is one of the fastest-growing parts of Sun's business, going from $0 to $1 billion in just 2 years. And Sun is now applying the same principle to all its computer components. Niagara has certainly helped Sun's balance sheet at a time when other parts of its business have been weak. Sun figures that an official tax on carbon, once it arrives, will drive more customers to this kind of processing solution, so it is trying to get ahead of the curve. Not only is Sun helping its customers with their computing, but it is also helping them with their image, because more and more of Sun's customers are telling their customers that they are going green, and Sun is giving them the basis to make that claim.